This edition of the Packet Pushers podcast is brought to you by SolarWinds. Did you know you can discover, map, and monitor your network in under an hour? SolarWinds award-winning Network Performance Monitor is an affordable, easy-to-use tool that delivers real-time views and dashboards to help you detect, diagnose, and resolve issues before real damage is done. Visit SolarWinds.com for a fully functional 30-day trial of Network Performance Monitor today. Thank you for listening to the Packet Pushers podcast, a program about data networking for nerds, by nerds, and published once a week. Well, sometimes more than once a week, and if I'm honest, sometimes less than that. In any case, we are in our third year of talking to interesting people about interesting packety topics, and I don't think we're going to run out of things to chat about anytime soon. We dive deep and peg the nerd meter on topics like routing protocols, switching, security, IPv6, data center overlays, IETF standards, and so on. Now, if this is your first time hearing the podcast, you might want to visit packetpushers.net to take in the full spectrum of 100% free quality content that we offer. There's multiple podcast feeds, blog feeds, and even a job posting area where great companies looking for people like you advertise about their work opportunities. You can also follow the show on Twitter, @packetpushers, find us on Facebook, join the Packet Pushers podcast group on LinkedIn, and go to old school retro chat on irc.freenode.net in the Packet Pushers channel. I am Ethan Banks, blogger, network engineer, and CCIE. You can follow me on Twitter @ecbanks and read my blogging @packetpushers.net. @EthereumMind, Mr. Greg Farrell is joining us today as well from the UK. And how does the day find you, sir?
Deliberately suppressing Monty Python jokes. Do you know why?
Why?
Because Cisco says the Cutlass 6500 is not dead, you know, and all I can see, there's a blog post on Cisco's website today, right, and it says the Cat 6500 is alive and well, and all I can envisage is a cart going down the road and a man going, bring out your dead, bring out your dead, and he goes, here you go, how much for this one? He's not dead yet, can't you do something about that? Hang on, give me a sec. Dead now.
He's stone dead in a minute.
Yeah, that's right, he'll be right. I'm very fine, I'm breathing fine. Look, I've never been better. SSX, give it a bullet. Double barrels.
No, the 2T breathed, it kind of made it a zombie now. It's like the Walking Dead with the 2T soup engine. So it's going to be around for a while, I'm afraid.
I'm very afraid. But, hey, let's not forget that a decade of faithful service and retarded features, and we've never been able to move forward into a bright future of new features and capabilities until the Nexus 7000 came along, and actually maybe it's not too bad, it's still alive.
Okay, I can see it's going to be one of those sorts of shows where you're in a mood. But I'm going to ask you to be nice to our guest today because we have some people on that have never been on before. We are talking to some folks from the University of New Hampshire's Interoperability Lab here in the U.S. New Hampshire happens to be the state here in America that I am from, and the University of New Hampshire is practically in my backyard, about an hour's ride away or so. And the folks at the IOL were nice enough to give me and Chris Margit, who's been on the podcast several times, a tour of the facility and discuss with us the value that the IOL brings to the networking industry. So I thought we'd do a show with these guys so that they could kind of tell the audience about the IOL. And then what originally got my how I became aware that the IOL even existed was because I was doing some research on Broad Outreach and the One Pair Ethernet Alliance, which is an emerging standard that the automotive industry has interest in, Broad Outreach being the standard and the One Pair Ethernet Alliance being the organization. IOL is really involved in that, and then I discovered all these other cool things that the IOL does. So the show today will be, let's talk about the IOL for a little bit, and then let's get into the One Pair Ethernet Alliance and talk about Broad Outreach, because Ethernet over one pair to me, especially putting in cars, it just hit my nerd button. It's like, oh, that's cool. I want to know about that. And so there's a couple of guys that were nice enough to join us today, Jeff Lepak, Senior Manager for Ethernets at the IOL, and also Dave Estes, Manager for Ethernets at the IOL. And thanks for joining us, guys.
Thanks very much for having us on.
Jeff, you want to tee off the conversation, kind of give everyone an introduction to the IOL. You know, tell us what it is, what you guys do, a little bit of history, the role it plays in the industry today, because when you guys gave me the tour, it blew me away. I was, how did I not know that you existed?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And, you know, I apologize if I ramble on here a little bit. UNH IOL has been around since 1988, and primarily what we are is an industry-leading independent third-party test facility for the data communications industry. So we're a vendor-neutral environment where people can come together, kind of debug problems they're experiencing in, you know, their protocol stack or in their switches, figure out why it's not working, and then come to a solution. The big thing that we do here that fosters that vendor neutrality is we really place a high emphasis on the confidentiality of our testing. So our testing is always between us and the vendor that came in to request the testing. We don't put it on a website or publish it in any other way. We leave it up to them to do it. We're in a 32,000 square foot facility in Durham, which is just off campus, off the University of New Hampshire campus. We have about 20 full-time staff members who act as kind of the business administrators here. But most of the actual work is done by undergraduate students. So we have about 100, maybe 120 at any given time, undergraduate and graduate level students that are pursuing programs here that actually are the test engineers for the IOL. We do testing in about 25 different technology areas. Pretty much every aspect of data communications you guys can think of. We do all flavors of Ethernet from 10 megabits per second to 40 and 100 gigabits per second. We are in spaces in like broadband access doing DSL or GPON testing. We're in storage technologies like SAS and SATA and fiber channel. And then we do a huge amount of protocol testing for bridges like spanning tree and that kind of thing, as well as IPv6, which, as you guys know, is kind of blowing up at the moment. Primarily, our model is a membership model where companies who are building products can come in, join in a particular technology area for a year-long membership, which allows them to kind of keep their budgeting in line. That year-long membership just costs them a flat fee, and then they can come in on a first-come, first-served basis as many times as they need to. And right now, we're working with about 150 companies all across the world, obviously focused in areas like Silicon Valley and you know, the Asia-Pacific areas, but we have a lot of local folks as well. And the membership model allows us to build what we call test beds. So as a member, you come in and you leave at least a representative piece of equipment so that other members can come in and test against your box. So that's really one of the ways that we help foster that environment where everybody's kind of participating together. Those memberships also are the sole source of our funding. So we're 100% funded by the industry. We're not funded by the university or the state or the federal government to any real extent. We're funded by companies that need to come in and actually do testing, which keeps us razor focused on actually delivering a real a service to the industry. Unique to kind of a test lab environment, we also have a huge participation in the standards bodies themselves. So we're active members in IEEE standards, IETF standards, Broadband Forum, and other folks are actually defining the open methods to for people to build around. And then we work as well with the industry forums for that do the marketing of technologies like Wi-Fi Alliance or Ethernet Alliance, the IPv6 forum, groups like that. It's unique to test labs in that we bring back a lot of the testing that we've done into the standards process so that the next standard is better, more robust. We fill in some of the holes as well as push back some maintenance items of things that might be more clear or might be missing in a current specification. So I think that kind of wraps up the first part of the IOL's mission, which is, you know, providing a neutral environment for multi-vendor interoperability, conformance to standards, and just generally improving data communications. We also have a second part of our mission, which is attracting students and training them in cutting-edge technologies. So as I mentioned, we have about 100 to 120 undergraduate and graduate students at any time. They're not getting, you know, course credit or anything like that. This is an actual job for them with an hourly rate. And we're training them to have actual real skills. So they're the people doing the testing. They're authoring our test reports. They're out there working with engineers from our member companies who are building the products to debug things. And that's our second product is actually the people graduating from our facility. You know, they're coming out of
that's
here.
Awesome. With I've always got a problem getting access to cheap labor. Oh, sorry. Say that out loud. That's you know, we need to set up a university, Ethan, so we can get a pool of students to do some stuff.
Well, it's cheap labor on the front end, but I mean, Jeff, the interesting thing when I was talking to you guys was the job placement that you guys have as a result for your students. I mean, it's something like a 99% placement rate very often into some pretty high-end positions out there in the industry because of the experience they get at the IOL.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't hurt to be debugging and working on actual products before you get hired by the company that wants you to help build it next time. So we act as like a conduit for a lot of businesses. They can just come in and kind of swipe our senior level guys, and then we have to go through the process of training all those new incoming people. So there's a lot of great employees that are getting, you know, great positions coming right out of school.
You had mentioned some of the technologies that you cover, and you mentioned, I think this is a really interesting point to make, that when we went on the tour, this came up as well, that you're still testing 10 meg Ethernet. And I think Chris Margot asked the question on the tour, why 10 meg Ethernet? Isn't that deader than dead?
You'd be surprised how many people are still building, you know, new chips with different lower power or different takes on old technology. And one of the things we provide is a great test bed for those people to come in and test against old equipment that's sitting somewhere in somebody's, you know, closet, networking closet or central office, and they can come in and actually test against a product that they might end up being plugged into. So it just gives a whole lot more confidence when you're trying to release a product.
Yeah, and by testing and some of the test beds that you do, it's not just, hey, I connected point A to point B and Ethernet came up. I guess we're done here. But you guys get as crazy as custom circuit boards that can introduce physical layer errors and challenges into the Ethernet framing down at the electrical signal layer and just see how things behave.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, so we focus both on just the generic interoperability, like you said, but also conformance to the spec. So if there's a shell buried somewhere in a huge IETF specification that says, you know, the bit sequence 01011 does X, Y, and Z, we'll actually build the test harness that can go in, replicate that environment, and make sure that the device performs how it's supposed to perform.
I thought another aspect of the way you test that was really interesting was, as we were walking through, you've got a couple of walls of equipment that you've collected over the years through different test beds that you've built, and there's a randomization process you follow to see, well, which of these pieces of equipment that's in the rack, some of which is fairly new, some of which is pretty old, you're going to run your test against.
Yeah, you know, again, we let our members kind of guide us. So, you know, we can run that multiple ways when they come in to test. Sometimes they'll be building a product and they might want to sell it to, you know, some big name company or another. So they'll need to test against, you know, a particular set of, you know, I don't know, Catalyst 6500 since it came up. Or in the other case, they just want to come in and get a good feel for kind of the broad what's generally out there. In that case, we can randomize from, you know, thousands of products. You know, here's a sampling of 30 random products, different switches and NICs and that kind of stuff that you might encounter out there. And then they can come back in again and, you know, and keep cycling through and test as much as they need to.
Yeah, it was quite a facility, quite a fun walkthrough. Every time we turned a corner, Chris and I would be going, oh, that's cool. What do you do with that? And then we'd get another education on what this clever bit of testing kit was doing. It was pretty awesome. Now, there's also emerging things that you guys are involved in where it's not established standards, but it's things that are up and coming that vendors are working on to eventually release to market, but have not been released to market yet. And one of those things, and what I was researching that led me to you, as I mentioned earlier, was the was Broad Rreach and the One Pair Ethernet Alliance. And can you talk a bit about the role you or Dave, as the case may be, whoever's going to take that question, talk about what Broad Rreach is all about and what the One Pair Ethernet Alliance is all about?
Sure, I'll answer that one. Broad Rreach is a standard that was originally written by Broadcom Corporation. And the goal of this is to create 100 megabits per second Ethernet that operates over one twisted pair rather than the current four pairs that we're using at the moment on the Cat5 cables. So it operates over one twisted pair, which is great because it cuts down on the cost of the cabling, cost of the connectors, and the weight of the cabling significantly. This standard was picked up by the Open Alliance, which is a industry alliance made up of over 70 members, with the goal of facilitating the use of Ethernet-based communication in the automotive industry. And they achieved that goal in several manners. One is through just the marketing and direct publications related to supporting broader reach inside the automotive. And the other is that there's actually five technical committees inside the Open Alliance that all focus on different aspects of the current standard and future standards, so that to make sure there's always a pipeline of products and applications ready and tools and ways to test the current standard.
Automotive industry is the big focus here for broader reach. And what's the technical driver for that? I mean, like, give us some use cases for this. I mean, I guess we're all kind of aware that there's a lot of new infotainment systems that are showing up in cars. Is that really it, or is there more beyond that that's pushing Ethernet into an automobile?
Nope, there's a lot more beyond that. The first use case that's going to be in a car going into production in 2013 is going to be as a rear view camera, where if they want to get the resolution that they need for the driver's assistance, the safety systems, they need a much higher bandwidth than what was available through FlexRoy or through CAN. So they targeted using a type of Ethernet because it was very scalable and flexible. So they wanted to use Ethernet as the next way to increase the bandwidth, and they came across broader reach, and it hits all of the goals they needed: the higher bandwidth, the low cost, and then the low weight.
So by low weight, we're talking about one pair of cable that is now. So for my sake, when I think of Ethernet, I think of, as you were saying earlier, the traditional four pair, eight conductors, each pair twisted at a certain number of twists per foot, depending on what category of cable it is. And then each twisted pair twisted around each other yet again inside of a containing sheath that gives the cable the characteristics required to transmit at 100 megabits per second or a gigabit per second and so on. So you say one pair and then dropping it, I'm thinking, okay, what is this cable actually like? Because in a car, EMI, electromagnetic interference, is a big enemy of Ethernet signaling. So is this cable something really special that can resist that, or has a super high twist count? It seems like one pair, you're potentially exposing that signal to a horrible environment in a car.
There is quite a horrible environment in the car, but actually this is just a regular two-conductor, one-pair twisted wire. It's very similar to the wires that they're using in the cars right now for FlexRoy and for CAN. The Open Alliance is currently defining right now the twist rate and the exact cable specifications that are required for this. But they have shown that over the standard cables that they're using already in the automotive industry, that they are able to meet all of the EMC requirements that they have.
So it doesn't have to be a shielded cable or anything like that. And I guess, in fairness, it's only 100 megabit per second spec, which is going to be more tolerant. Plus, I think when we were talking earlier about this, you made the point that the distances are pretty short too, which also helps.
Cat3 cable was good enough for 100 meg Ethernet.
For 100
Cat3
meters,
Cat3 was only barely better than a piece of... For 100 meters, and Cat3 was better than a piece of thin barbed wire. So, you know, getting 100 meg working... Let's not overstate it.
Well, we did actually run 100 meg back in the day over barbed wire just to prove that it could be done. So that's actually a very good point.
Everybody gets bent up about RF interference and actually realize that it's not as anyway. But yeah, your stereo in your car uses the same speaker wire as your house does. So the RF environment isn't that bad if you can plug the stereo speakers into your radio with a normal thing. It's only when your distributor, when the old days, it used to be a problem when your distributor cap wasn't firing properly and your points were off and they'd generate sparks. That was the only time you ever had speaker wire problems. Maybe all the young people today have forgotten about these sorts of things. Anyway, on with the show. I'm being grumpy now.
So, okay, so another question that kind of comes to mind is, okay, it's one pair. So does that mean half duplex communications or not?
Nope, this actually uses the same technology that they use for 1000 base T or gigabit Ethernet, and that is being able to transmit bidirectionally on each pair. So in gigabit Ethernet, they do it on four pairs, and here they only have to do it on one pair, but it's full duplex bidirectional traffic on the same twisted pair.
And it's, I mean, it's Ethernet. So, I mean, a network engineer that's used to looking at a packet capture and say Wireshark and can see a full Ethernet frame is used to seeing a frame formatted in a particular way. Is this the same frame format or is it different?
This is the exact same frame format. Everything from the MII layer and up is identical to any other Ethernet device you will find out there.
Car Ethernet is identical to ordinary Ethernet. What makes it special then? Just the hardened physical equipment, so the switching gear is a little bit more robust and susceptible, not so susceptible to power fluctuations?
So as far as the standard goes, the only differences are just that it uses only one twisted pair so that they can save on weight and cost. And then also because of the type of signaling that they use, they are able to meet all the EMC requirements.
I love that. Save on weight and cost. And then your chair, the seat's actually got a computer system underneath it to remember which size ass went in it last time. Whether
surprising amount of bandwidth. So.
Yeah, we put one core in there. We save 25 grams. Yes. Now we can put a bigger seat in the thing.
Yeah. Now, actually, Greg, that brings up an interesting point because the seats and the mirrors and the backup cameras and the entertainment system and everything else has got some kind of a computer and it in theory could be wired up to this thing. So is there some kind of a switch or a hub that all of these devices would wire to? You know, like a hub and spoke topology like a lot of network engineers would think of.
Yep, it's exactly like that. It's a hub and spoke technology that they will be using with a central switch with the backplane running from the front to the back or wherever they decide that they need the most connectivity. And then from there, it would break out into the individual cameras or the speakers or the sensors that they need to communicate with.
So then another possible application that comes to mind, a lot of cars have, well, I don't know if it's still true, but it used to be the OBD2 sensor, and you had to have a special computer to plug into that thing to pull information, check engine codes, and these kind of things, and do diagnostics on the vehicle. Is there a potential to change those interfaces to something that's more like a regular Ethernet jack?
That will be a much slower change because the OBD2 standard is specified by, I don't remember if it's the Department of Safety or if it's just the SAE, but there is potential that it will be able to be used for the diagnostics. I know they're using this for when they need to flash firmware, or they're using regular Fast Ethernet already when they need to flash the firmware in order to get the bandwidth to save on the amount of time that it takes. So as far as diagnostics go, for a standardized thing, it could definitely be used for that.
Our cars are just turning into a regular computer. I love it.
It gets a lot scarier when you start to add in, future down the line, things like Wi-Fi, where cars are talking to each other, and then all of this data is available on some sort of networking topology. So, in the future, it'll get even more complex.
Well, actually talking to each other, but also talking to presumably some kind of a centralized road system that where the roads can communicate to the vehicles and give guidance about any number of things from traffic conditions to distances to get certain places depending on what's going on with weather and so on. I've heard about that. Is that potentially a part of this?
This is only for the in-car communication. So once it receives the information that it needs through whatever wireless way to get the road information, then it could definitely be distributed within the car through this.
Now that the vehicles are being networked so thoroughly, we're getting to that point where all of the sci-fi stuff that I read as a kid growing up is starting to come true. The cars are talking to each other, the cars are talking to the road, and all of which is talking back to something central. And I might be able to press that autopilot button before too awful long and just get something useful out of that hour-long commute to the office instead of having to actually drive.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed, so...
How long before we see broad outreach in vehicles? I mean, because this is really an emerging standard. It's not, no one's doing this quite today.
Actually, it starts production for a rear-view camera in 2013, so next year.
With expectation that that's going to become kind of the way you wire a vehicle for data communications?
Yes, that's where they're going to start for now. And then in 2015, they're expecting to introduce it for driver assistance systems.
Meaning driver assistance systems, meaning like radar in your blind spot and lane, unexpected lane change. I forgot the acronym for that one. Those sorts of things?
Yes, like collision avoidance systems or early warnings for collision or like the blind spot monitoring.
There's also a lot more potential to put more cameras than just the rear view camera in, a blind spot camera, a camera looking back into the rear seat. There's, you know, the extra bandwidth that it provides allows them to put in a whole bunch more sensors that, you know, we haven't even really thought about putting in yet.
Right. Eventually the cars will be so expensive and loaded with sensors, we won't be able to afford them. Well, I mean, some of the luxury brands are kind of that way anyway. You know, the big Mercedes and the big BMWs and so on that have a lot of that feature functionality in there. You're into, you know, quite a lofty price tier before you can get a vehicle equipped in that way. It'll be interesting to see how long it takes for some of this stuff to trickle down, because now rear view cameras are ubiquitous. They're almost all vehicles. At least have the option of having one, and even entry level cars have it. So then again, some of this stuff is being mandated by government, so that's forcing the technology into the vehicles as well.
Good thing we saved weight with those cables.
That's right.
Damn lucky.
Well, let me ask a question here about the IOL in general. If someone wanted to go and observe, say, some testing that you folks were doing with broad outreach or maybe other sorts of events that the IOL is involved with, is there a way that the public can be engaged with the IOL?
Well, as I mentioned at the top, most of our day-to-day testing, we try to keep extremely confidential between us and the member company that came in. But we do an awful lot of events with industry forums and or our own events where we kind of call them like a group test event or a plug fest, where in an emerging technology, a bunch of people who are all making it but haven't really tried it out can come together, plug together in the same room facing each other and work through the problems. And oftentimes an event like that, we can open up a particular day or have a demonstration of that technology where people might be able to come in and view it, or you know, some press might be able to come in and see the event. The list of events that are currently happening at our lab are always listed on our website. And if there's one in particular that a person was interested in coming up and seeing, if they wanted to reach directly right out to us, we might be able to arrange something like that.
Pretty cool. So plug fests, I find it fascinating that vendors with theoretically competing products, well, not theoretically, certainly competing products, sitting there across the table from each other working out the bugs. But then again, the guys that are doing this are really the engineers.
That's absolutely true, and you know, us good old engineers always just want to solve the problem. Be damned to the marketing team.
So, back to broad outreach for a minute. Something just popped in my head. Now, what specific testing are you folks doing, and is there maybe like a roadmap of features that you can disclose? I know there's some element of, you know, privacy that the Open Alliance has right now, where they're not talking about everything that's going on, but what can you talk about as far as the specific testing and maybe roadmap kind of stuff?
Sure. For the testing, we're going to start with what we've actually completed already is some PMA testing on two of the devices already, and that's to make sure that the electrical signaling characteristics are all within spec, exactly where they should be. And then in the future, what we're going to be doing is the next testing we're developing is interoperability testing that will go between multiple devices. What we need to figure out for that is the automotive industry is slightly different than what we've worked with in the past. And so there are different requirements as far as what kinds of worst case scenarios could you experience in a car, which is very different than the worst case scenarios you experience when you're in a data center. So we're working with the Open Alliance to define all the new requirements for that. After interoperability, we will be moving on to testing the physical coding sublayer as well as the MAC layer.
Now, by worst case scenario in a car being different than a data center, I'm assuming you mean a crash, a fire, you know, these sorts of things.
Actually, these are the everyday working situations that you might experience in a car. So, for example, you have temperature extremes in a car that you don't reach in a data center. Data centers are typically air conditioned and right at room temperature, and cars can get below freezing or very warm on a hot day. So there's a lot of different requirements there. Plus, the noise is very different, as you stated. So there could be a higher noise channel that you have to be able to tolerate than what you would have to be able to tolerate in the data center.
Now, with the interoperability testing, the vendors that you're dealing with are any number of folks out in the automotive industry that are making parts that Toyota might put in their vehicle, for example, but maybe not necessarily Toyota themselves.
Correct. All of the part suppliers and the chip manufacturers themselves would want to come and make sure that their products are going to work with the other products that could end up inside the same car. So if Continental is making an ECU and they want to make sure that it's going to work with an ECU from Bosch or a speaker from Harman or, you know, whoever is going to be inside the same car, they need to make sure that they're going to work together.
Well, I think we can wrap it up there. Cars fascinate me. So when you say you're going to put Ethernet in a car, then it's like, really? Okay. So so I appreciate the time you guys took to come on and chat. Again, Jeff Lepak and Dave Estes from the UNH Interoperability Lab. And we're going to stay in touch because as other events come up, like if a PlugFest comes up, it's a topic that might be of interest to the podcast listeners. Maybe we could arrange to be there. That would be interesting. See if we could come up with some content to record about that. That would be that is potentially something that would be fun.
Yeah, I think we could probably squeeze you in.
Okay, very good. And Mr. Farrow, thank you for joining us today. And do you have big plans this week? Things you'll be working on?
I do, but they're all super secret because they involve firewalls. And, of course, we all know that firewalls is like sexually transmitted diseases. We don't talk about whether we have them or not.
Exactly right. Very good.
And even if I had one, I couldn't mention if I had. And if I had one and I told you that I had, then I probably wouldn't want to talk about it.
Very good. That's security design right there. You now understand. Anyway, thank you for listening to the show this week. Remember that you can follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter at Packet Pushers and visit packetpushers.net to read blogs by the growing Packet Pushers community. There is still an open invitation to folks who would like to blog with Packet Pushers. Send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and introduce yourself, and I'll get you set up with a blogger account. Also at packetpushers.net, you can subscribe to our RSS feeds, and if you like, you could donate to the show. Email your comments or questions about this show to packetpushers@gmail.com. If you've got anything for the Interoperability Lab, I will make sure that the right folks at the IOL get the information if you've got any questions for them. And finally, remember that too much networking would never be enough.